Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
information that you can use and sometimes cannot use in court. My name is Martin Michelson. I'll be your host for this evening's conference call brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. You're on this call because of the situation in your life where you require legal advice, and I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone looking for legal advice has no place or business here on any of these calls. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes, just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions. As experienced and powerful as these folks' opinions might be, at the end of the day, they are just that. They're just people's opinions. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. Look up in the upper right-hand corner, see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you have a separate page come up with just two items on it, otherwise blank page. These two items are of much importance, especially if this is all new to you. On the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic concept of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you might find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process. Of course, primarily known for its very high win rate, 95-97% national average win rate throughout the country. That's what it's pretty much known for. That's what it's most commonly procured for. But that's not why it's up here. The reason that it's up here, once you've gone through the jurisdictionary course and you start getting into the common law default, you'll see very quickly that it almost acts like a real-life homework assignment. So especially if you're starting out fresh in this thing, this is all brand new to you. A lot of folks, I feel more comfortable getting their feet wet for their first time with a traffic scenario, given the fact that it's a traffic scenario. Of course, it's going to happen for most traffic cases. Worst case scenario, if you mess something up, you just have to pay a ticket or whatever it may be. And so, but the core pillars that you learned about in the jurisdictionary line up perfectly with what the common law default is having you enact. So, it's just a great starting point. With a very generous asking of just a very meager contribution of $250 for the jurisdictionary and $150 for the common law default, I encourage you to pick that up at your earliest convenience. Also, while you're there, right underneath that login there, you'll see register. Whenever you're ready, whenever you it's convenient for you, you want to click on register. And again, a very, very meager asking of a $10 a month monthly contribution. Gives you full membership to Your Remedy, many wonderful features, study aids, books. Of course, every call is recorded. You've got years and years of archives, a vast wealth of knowledge and experience there to listen to on these calls. Now, of course, if you're not ready for that or if that's not for you just yet, you've got freedomsradio.com, www.freedomsradio.com. Every call is broadcasted out over the air. That is completely free of charge. It's free to you. You don't ever have to miss a call again if you don't wish. You're not going to get the one-on-one again with the information providers like you could get at Your Remedy for the membership, but even at Freedoms Radio, you get that little question bar there where you can type in a question or comment as long as you remember to click submit. That will pop up on our side, and we do our best to read every one of those out. We're usually pretty much 100% successful on that, and we read all those out over the air. So, again, you never have to miss a call again or an interaction if you don't wish, but it is encouraged to pick up your Remedy membership as soon as you're able to. All right. Keep it going here. Grassfire Communications. better known as formerly statewide communications. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. What we're trying to do here very simply is put the power of communication and the power of education back in the hands of the common man. You've got a very simple install wizard, setup wizard. You know, put your name in here, click next, zip code, click next. Then it's going to ask you to pick from a very long list of topics. No matter what your situation, no matter what you're thinking of, you'll find it in that list or close enough to it, whether it's a status correction or home foreclosures, credit cards, traffic, human rights, veterans' rights, health rights, just on and on. You'll find it in that list. Then there's something about a radius there. Do you want it, you know, just within 5 miles of your house or about 50 miles out? Your choice there. Give you a few different options at least, I'm sure. And when it's all done, it puts it together. Kind of, well, most people would probably speak of the social media, but it's nothing like social media. It's very custom. It's very private. But how some people would feel about social media, it puts you in contact there with local people there that share similar interests. So you know, maybe you jump on there one day and say, this happens to me today. Well, the first person comes back and says, well, I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's a very truthful statement, but it's probably not going to help you very much in your educational process. Maybe the next person comes in and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do if I was similarly situated. I'd go down to my local county courthouse, go to the law library. By the way, if you didn't know, every county has its courthouse. Every courthouse has a law library. I'd look up these terms, and then I'd watch this YouTube video. Well, now you're starting to get somewhere. Now you're actually getting some information that you might actually be able to use there to educate yourself. Maybe the third person comes along and says, I think that's a great idea. Also, I'd go to this website, urevenuesandlaw.com, and I'd purchase this educational process. I'd talk to this person. I'd watch these videos over here. Check out this speaker, what he's got. Now you're really getting somewhere. Now you're getting traction. And that's, again, all we're trying to do here is just put the power of communication and back in the hands of the common man, get people to start speaking again. If you're doing your own due diligence and you're just acting inside your rights, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. All right. You might have noticed every time you go to Your Remedies in the Law, that little blue box pops up, asks you if you want to continue on to the site you requested or go over to Americans Restoring America. The reason we've done that is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are many different information providers talking about many different topics. And that's all at Your Remedy. And Your Remedy is one of a dozen and a half websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. And so there's a lot there for you to see, and we're just encouraging you to do that. If you ever have a question on whether we have an information provider that could assist you in your particular educational process, you can always call the 1-800 number, 1-800-625-4250. Again, that's 1-800-625-4250. Or you can always just email me directly, mmmartinmichelson@yourremediesinthelaw.com. I'll get you squared away as quickly as possible. All right, winding down here, this next portion is called your caveat emptor or your buyer beware. When you come aboard with an information provider here at Your Remedies in the Law, you're doing just that. You're going directly with an information provider. Now, not every plan of attack for every information provider, for every person is guaranteed to be a success. Of course, you know, nothing in life is ever guaranteed. Now, the plan is always to be successful. If there's any question of that, we encourage you to check out yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials and very quickly see what other folks have had to say. And we'll just kind of stand on that. But nothing is ever guaranteed. But that brings up the more important question of what is the refund or credit policy at Your Remedies in the Law. There is none. Again, if there was going to be anything of that nature, that would be a strict and private matter between you and your information provider. But even then, that's probably going to be extenuating circumstances. Usually, you're expected, again, to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. You're expected to have made that decision that you mesh well, that you think that you would do well with a student-teacher relationship with your information provider before you, you know, do that final commitment. All right, lastly here, and this goes for all the information provided, all of our speakers at Your Remedies in the Law. I'm just Brother John here. We want to remind everybody that all of these speakers at these calls are our guests and should always be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's perfectly fine. Disagreeing is how we learn. But you are always expected to be civil and maintain composure. Besides, if the question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we all get to learn something from it. All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening, Brother John. We're very excited to have you here. What have you got? Well, I told him, of course, our topic for tonight, being the some things that you may or may not.
Yeah, thank you for that very kind and gracious introduction, Martin. And our topic for tonight is, are you really legally a taxpayer? Oh, and by the way, for those of you who Martin's was talking about, if you have a disagreement or anything, if you have a disagreement at the end of the evening, we open it up for questions. It is our honor and privilege to entertain disagreements. And if we don't have an answer for you, it's our honor and privilege to look into it to see if we can find an answer for you. Now, having said that, in response to a significant interest in from a lot of our students regarding the IRS. In fact, I have in my left hand right now a handful of fan mail from the United States attorney for one of our students that I'll be referring to some of it this evening. And this is a very, very interesting subject. Now, there's a path by which we've been seeking to have the IRS prove up to our students, and that I've had them attempted to have them prove up to students for many, many years now. Hang on a second, my throat's dry. I'm going to take a drink here. I guess you could say I am drinking on the job. Yeah, it's Gatorade, but I am drinking. Yeah, but there's a process by which we take individuals that are not in any kind of tangle or arrears, all the way up to the ones that are severely tangled and in arrears with the IRS, and we go over with them and show them how to inquire of the IRS if they are really a taxpayer, and we ask them to prove it. And we walk them through creating their own correspondence, and some of this correspondence, some of it looks very similar to others, just by the nature of who the coaches are and who the information providers are. And some of it, the students have come up with some very, very diverse ways of approaching it. But there is an ABC procedure to put these communications into play and walk them through this. And at this juncture, I'm going to go ahead and read a little bit of one page of the fan mail that was received yesterday, Friday, from this one student. In the table of contents in the pleading and a motion to dismiss, this student's initial saying, hey, look, I'm not a taxpayer. You need to prove that up. And and here's evidence of your own issues of not proving it up. And this is all United States, and we all use exclusively letters from the IRS and United States Code for this. Now, used to be up until about 18 or 20 months ago, and actually it's going on about 20 months ago, we almost never got any pushback on this. And now we're getting a whole lot of pushback from U.S. attorneys, and we think they're starting to squirm a little bit because as you'll find out later on in this session, they don't appear to have standing. But And but they under argument, they it says the there's says the. Says the defendant is, or the plaintiff is using, and in this case it's the plaintiffs because we are the ones that filed against them. It says the plaintiffs, their arguments are frivolous and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and should be dismissed because they're frivolous. And they're, and in one of the points in one of the paragraphs, it says plaintiffs fails to demonstrate the court has subject matter jurisdiction, except that if. Okay, when somebody says something's wrong, oh, you can say, oh, that food is bad for you, this food was bad for you, bad for you, bad for you. But until somebody says, this is good food, you should eat this, then we don't have the question actually answered. And if they're saying, you know, if, and, you know, you and I have all had those people in our lives that say, oh, don't do that, that's bad for you. Don't exercise that way, that can hurt your vertebrae. There, or that, don't eat that, that's, that food has all kinds of collateral challenges, eating that food, or don't use that drug. Well, to, if you have an infection and they're saying don't use that, then what I've come to say is that, well, wow, you say that this is bad, then that means you know which one to use. And it's unbelievable how many people accept the argument of just that's bad for you without asking, okay, what is good for me? And at this juncture, in this particular one, we're already pointing out that the U.S. government's attorney has failed to point out that there is a if this court does not have jurisdiction, which we've already proven it does, and we stated that initially, then which court does? And rather, and U.S. United States attorney, instead of saying we should have gone to this court and it shouldn't be in this in that one, or we should have gone to that court and it shouldn't be in this court, they just say it's wrong and expect it to get dismissed. And that's the argument that we use to, that's the response to that argument that we use to have that point voided, okay? And it says, the plaintiff fails to show that the United States waived sovereign immunity for any possible claims that they made. Okay, there's a doctrine of sovereign immunity that the United States can't be sued unless you give them permission, okay? Well, we at this case, the IRS is saying that they have jurisdiction and they to levy taxes, okay, and that because they have that jurisdiction, they have sovereign immunity. Well, okay, that's a good point. However, they never proved initially that they had the jurisdiction and that they have the status to be have sovereign immunity and levy income tax. And at this juncture, until they prove that they do have the status to levy tax, they don't have sovereign immunity. And so what we're doing is that we're backing them up one step before they and this particular pleading that I have in my left hand right now, it has 22 pages, and there's about seven more pages of supporting documentation and an additional pleading for it. And it's they've done a wonderful job of cutting down a forest so they could print paper and then send us the fan mail that, you know, that paper is, you know, that the information is printed on. And it says they failed. There's an anti-injunction and declaratory injunction act bar suit. And the thing is that that's only applicable to government jurisdictions that have already proven that they have standing for the authority that they're wielding. the IRS, and at this juncture, has not to date proven that. So technically, and what we're doing on that is backing them up to the issue of, by the way, Michael, would you like to invite our California student to this call?
Sure. Are you talking about the Roman Emperor?
Yeah.
Okay. One moment.
Yeah. See if they would like to join us on this call tonight.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, he's not crazy. This is the Roman Emperor. Just to make sure.
Yeah. What's happening is that backing them up to the place where they prove that they had standing to evade or avoid an injunction or declaratory suit, that's something that they have not yet done. And so to that end, it's very, very important that we don't get stuck in the mud on
the Roman Emperor has arrived.
Hello?
Has what?
The Roman Emperor has arrived.
Ah, okay. Elvis is in the house. Wonderful. In this 22-page document that I just finished reading through it for the third time since our student provided it to us. The U.S. Attorney, the Deputy Attorney General for the United States, and has made a lot of claims. And what's happening is that she's being very, very Miss Lee is being very, very careful to evade and avoid the issue that was addressed in our student's initial pleading. Hey, look, I'm not a taxpayer. Prove that I am. And if our student had been proven to be a taxpayer, then things like the Anti-Injunction Act and Declaratory Judgment Act bar suit against it. However, if we back them up and that we never proved that they had jurisdiction to levy taxes and to pursue this student or any other student, if we back them up to that, then the Anti-Injunction Act and the Anti-Declaratory Judgment Act can't apply because it only applies to government agencies that have established standing to be able to understand, to levy that. And once they've established standing, then they're given a privileged status so that it reduces the amount of complaints and paperwork that they have to deal with. Except that right now, we're making them prove their status and that they actually have status to levy tax. And this precious little state's attorney or United States attorney, she's Alice is trying to be very, very careful to evade and avoid that question. And as we go through this motion to dismiss the student's complaint, what's happening is we're finding out that she carefully words everything to avoid any possibility of being noted as not having fulfilled the requirements or request for proof that that they don't have standing. And what happens is that later on, something that's really, really important is that what happens is that they refer to damages that were sought under 26 U.S.C. 7433. In this case, there's a couple of million dollars. And it says the United States has not waived its sovereign immunity against any possible claims. Well, if now in this case, the IRS or the U.S., the U.S. government has not proven that they have standing, then those were wrongfully collected, and it doesn't have protection against for the sovereign immunity. If they're saying that they can commit an illegal act and still have sovereign immunity, the sovereign immunity only applies while they are acting with legal within the legal confines of the United States Code, in this case, Chapter 26, or paraphrased, coloring between the lines. They also talk about that they refer to the student as a taxpayer, and they also say that there's the student must exhaust all, or the taxpayer must exhaust all these remedies, and then it takes a minimum of 6 months before they can file. But if the taxpayer was, if the individual was never and is not currently legally and legitimately a taxpayer, then then that statute doesn't and cannot apply. And there's and they refer to our student made a claim under 26 U.S.C. 7422 and if our student was a taxpayer, there's under they're saying that one of the stipulations are that before a request for a refund can be made is that that it takes 6 months to process, and if the taxpayer fails to exhaust all the remedies that are provided for at that relate to 26 U.S.C. 7422, then it's dismissed. But if they comply with all those, the thing is that if technically they have to jump through those hoops because they are a taxpayer, they're saying that you're already in their jurisdiction. Oh, there is that word, jurisdiction. The thing that's very vitally important here is that the IRS and United States attorneys consider everyone under the jurisdiction of the IRS. And so presently, under at Americans Restoring America, we're working on briefs right now to show at the recommendation of a U.S. District Court judge that regularly hears tax cases, and I'm not going to say which jurisdiction this individual's in, but he said the first two times that I saw this couple in my court, I knew that we had jurisdiction. But he said when the argument that you explain to them that they wrote up, when they wrote it up, and all of a sudden I realized why we didn't have jurisdiction, because it was never originally proven that they were a taxpayer, and there's no United States code that initiates and pulls the trigger that says a person that's born in this state that has that birth certificate, et cetera, is automatically a U.S. taxpayer. There is nothing to that. And to that end, a lot of the guidelines for the IRS have been set up, but jurisdiction has never, ever, ever been one of the ones that has been fully and properly established. And so what's happening is that this judge actually asked this couple with the DAG, the Deputy Attorney General, present in chambers where they learned all this, and they – you know, they freely gave the judge my name and the Deputy Attorney General, and also there was an attorney for the IRS there, and they gave my name, and they called me up, and actually I wasn't available at the moment, but they kept calling, and I was, and I ended up available, and I ended up on a Zoom call, or a, not a Zoom call, but a Microsoft Teams call, a court Teams call. And you know why the courts don't use Zoom, right? If some of you don't, there are people that offer free software or free apps, mobile apps, do this through the Apple App Store or Google Play Store or whatever. And these people getting these apps think that the app is the product. Quite the opposite. Actually, you're the product. And one person explained to me how the McDonald's app works, in that the people that are paying McDonald's, and so that hang on a second. The people that are paying McDonald's to operate those apps, when you download that app so you can get that discount, that these people are helping subsidize McDonald's, so that McDonald's, whether you actually buy the product or not, is getting some income just because you have the app. And what happens is that they are tracking your GPS location based on the GPS lock on your cell phone. And so what happens is that someone that was very, very good with the soup, Alphabet Soup Group, made a point by, he booted up a brand new cell phone, a burner, or a prepaid cell phone, and put only one app on it, the McDonald's app, and all of a sudden, through multiple subscriptions agencies, people could buy your GPS that had your CEISN on it, your cell phone electronic identification serial number, and they were able to track the phone to within inches within the park where this gentleman, he refused to hold it at this meeting at his office or home or any place. He held it in the park, and he walked around the park, and he showed how to track. You could zoom in, and he went into the handy market at the gas station in the corner, and you could tell exactly which aisle that he was standing at. The resolution is that good. Well, a lot of the conference call software, including Zoom, I had somebody call me up and say, John, you're on a Zoom call right now. And they called me up on a home landline. And I says, yeah, how'd you know? He says, I'm going to play this for you. And there was a significant latency, but everything that was being said on that call, and he says, you realize that how long ago did you start your call? I says, about 25, 28 minutes ago. He goes, you realize that there are 41 people logged on that are paying the equivalent of about $25 per person to listen to your call. And he says, I need to talk to you later. And later on, he explained to me that over in China, they have these servers that they record everything that's said on a Zoom call. And so that it's downloaded into an ASCII flat file and available for anybody to purchase, and mostly on the dark web or the black web, you know. But even Microsoft Teams now is not secure. There's a few others. If you have to use a video call, recommend using CloudHub. It's the least unsecure at the moment. Then that I promise you that will change. What happened was we logged on, and I got a call about 3 or 4 minutes after I logged on that, you know, from somebody in the kitchen, and they said, look, you're on a call, right? And I says, yeah, it's very important. And I explained, I walked the judge and the prosecutor through the student's objection to jurisdiction and why and how, and both deputy attorney generals that were present, there was a female and a male, at first they started to object, and I says, you realize that you're not required to pay income tax either. And the male says, how can that possibly, he was stuttering. He says, how can that possibly be? I says, well, and we, 26 USC 6203 says any person liable is how it starts out. It's not everybody. He says, that can't be true. And he went and looked it up, and there was the holy shaving cream Batman comment on the Zoom call, and the judge asked the DAG to refer to, to refrain from that type of language. I says, yeah, I don't speak French. Could we stay to the English? Would that be okay? And I disarmed the situation because the DAG was getting upset, and I don't like situations where we're making other people upset. And what happened was is that it's true, it's very upsetting, but what happened is that we walked through the 6203 direction, and I explained to them, I says, before any of these immunities can apply, we have to have proven that this person is a taxpayer. And because those immunities against being sued only apply between the IRS and are only related between the IRS or the U.S. government and individuals that are taxpayers. Individuals that are not taxpayers, that does not apply to them. And the specific codes that it talks about for the Declaratory Judgment Act specifically state taxpayer, the word taxpayer. And they said, no, it's everybody. I said, no, look at it. So this couple, in Your Honor, with all due respect, Mr. and Mrs. Deputy Attorney General here, Mr. and Mrs. Deputy Attorney General, I understand you're pleading this case on behalf of the IRS, and has the IRS ever proven to you that you have personally that they have jurisdiction, and when and where they got that jurisdiction? And the lady all of a sudden, no, but that's not. And before she said, she stopped and right halfway through the word, not necessary. And she started stuttering and says, wait a minute. She says, now she was stuttering. She says, you have a good point here. And the attorney for the IRS, she blew through the ceiling. Your Honor, everybody's just responsible. And the judge says, and he banged his gavel a couple times and says, could you please be quiet for a moment? He brought up that question, any person liable out of 6203. It sounds like you already know, like what he just said a little while ago, sounds like you already know the answer, so give us the answer. Well, she started stuttering. I said, Your Honor, you're correct. If she knew the answer, she would have given it to us a long time ago. In fact, in the initial pleadings, if you look at exhibits F, G, and H in the appendices in the brief and support of the motion, you'll see that those questions were asked, and actually in one of them that the person that she refers to that she was working with the IRS is the person that wrote the letter to this couple, and the couple responded to her, so she has personal knowledge of the individual. And if she had that information, this lady erupted, object, and the judge finally, he slapped his gavel twice. I didn't say a thing. I was quiet, and the couple was looking into the camera at me. And, I know they could see me on the screen, and I just kind of nodded horizontally, she went on for almost a minute. It was unbelievable. Of course, again, when you're in a courtroom situation like that, a minute can seem like an eternity, and it did. It really, truly did. And at this juncture, I was very concerned about what the judge was going to say. I was thinking, oh, boy, here it comes. We're going to get a ventilator full of fecal matter. The judge says, you know what? He's right. If you had the answer, you would have given it to us. And their point is well made. And your point that your objections, you all stray away from answering. You conspicuously stay away from answering the question. And the Deputy Attorney General, the gentleman says, well, Your Honor, we didn't. He says, and he says, stopped him, and he says, you're right. You didn't prove jurisdiction. And to that end, he says, we're going to take a 20-minute recess, and I'm going to come back, and I need to think about this. And he says, would you please take time with the plaintiffs in this case and see if you can sort this out when we come back so that I don't have to. Well, they came back at 25 minutes, and they asked the judge, could they have a recess for 2 days? And this was on Tuesday, and that to a Thursday. He granted it till Friday. And the couple, what happened was is that I ended up flying up to go see him, and we met with the Deputy Attorney General, and we ended up coming up with an agreed-to motion to dismiss, and with which the IRS attorneys and the United States attorney all agreed that this couple and their three children were not required to file income tax. I tried to get it to perpetuity. We couldn't get that quite that far. I couldn't play that card because the government hadn't played the right card to allow that to be bought into question. But what's happening is that in this 22-page document that I'm looking at, it says the plaintiffs failed to state a cognizable legal claim. Well, if they're taxpayers, then there isn't a cognizable legal claim. But if the claim is for the IRS has been committing fraud this whole way, and they unwittingly, without realizing that it didn't apply to them, have been paying, then that's fraud. And the IRS, and then that means that all monies paid were paid fraudulently. And under the umbrella of fraud, the guise of fraud, and therefore they were never due, any of them. Not one penny was ever due to the IRS. And so that's the claim, okay? And in this case, it says the plaintiffs failed to otherwise demonstrate that they're entitled to injunctive relief. Well, if the plaintiffs are, quote-unquote, taxpayers, then what happens is that injunctive relief for a taxpayer, wait a minute, if I'm a taxpayer, then I have a responsibility to file taxes. I can't seek injunctive relief. But if I was never proven to be a taxpayer, then the injunctive relief is to them either prove I am a taxpayer or leave me alone. And so what happens is that it says plaintiff does not address traditional factors of equitable relief. Well, the fact that they quoted back on page 15 of 22, they quote a figure that there's a compilation of figures there, and that they're quoting these figures that have a lot of places between them, that whole number on the left and the decimal place, you know, and the fact that they're says that that relief was sought after, and it is now they use the word equitable relief in this particular document that and I at this juncture if I would have had the chance to have this particular student on the call so that we could engage in discussions back and forth, I would do that, but I didn't have the time to I got a call this morning that I the doctors were wanting to schedule me for a preliminary procedure before my surgery tomorrow, and I've been downtown at the hospital all day, and down there, they don't let you use your cell phone most of the time, or they don't let you use your laptop because there's oxygen and all this other stuff, and to get surgery on my low back. But had I had the chance to get with this student in advance, I probably would have taken time. We probably would be taking time to engage with this student on this call for all of your benefits. Now, in the future, if we come to a place either with this student or other students that they're willing to engage in part of the class, part of our one-hour class here, then the other thing that I would ask the student to do is consent to engage in the Q&A afterward, if at all possible. But what we'll do is we'll see if we can have those or another student. We've got one student right now that they started levying his wages. He's a white collar worker. He 20 some odd years ago, they started levying him, and they levied him out of employment. And what happened was is that the company he was working with, it ended up getting so bad that they just he left the company. He wasn't technically fired, and but he did resign, and it was so bad because the IRS uses a lot of these. They have a letter where they say, this person is, we've got a question regarding them and regarding their taxes. And most employers take that almost as a U.S. District Court order of judgment and garnish. And what happens is that if they were only claiming two exemptions and now they revised, they've had situations where they withhold as if there was no exemptions and additional, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and they start garnishing without a court order. They start taking the money, and so what's happening is that we found out that the original challenge of jurisdiction, meaning that they never proved that this particular student and his wife were taxpayers. It says you can challenge jurisdiction anytime. And so to that end, with that particular student, and that's a current in process, and I received a whole bunch of fan mail today from that student that they were we're getting the court documents from those hearings so that we can the investigator that I had working on that one, so that they can give us a fill-in on which documents to go after and prove where we didn't see jurisdiction challenged. And what's happening is that if we pull the leg out of the chair, and that chair only has three legs on it, that little step stool, and if we pull one of those legs out, then that chair is going to collapse. And what's going to happen is that on top of that original judgment are further judgments against that individual's employer and wage garnishments and seizures and the home, everything. And got and sold everything. And so what's happening is that as more of these cases are coming forward, we're going to start to see a drastic change in the way the government and the IRS is coming after us. And I've had a couple of calls from gowns and gavels that said, John, you realize that, you know, that thing that you know that I ruled on from you, it went up the appellate level, the IRS went up the appellate level and they dismissed before they got a judgment. And I says, what do you mean? He says, they withdrew their appeal. And I says, why did they do that? He says, you don't understand. And I says, well, help me. He says, if the IRS appealed and it was overturned, and or they ran it to the end and they didn't get it overturned, then that's case law against them. And then every single other person that you're trying to help in the whole U.S. now has standing instantaneously in advance. And I says, and I told him, I says, but opinions are only opinions, Your Honor. And I says, even if it's a SCOTUS opinion, Supreme Court of the U.S., S-C-O-T-U-S, SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the U.S. So if you hear that acronym, if you hear me use it or others, SCOTUS, that's the Supreme Court of the U.S. And I says, even that is just an opinion. He says, but you don't understand other judges. I says, yes, I do understand. Only a week earlier, I had written, I had helped a student write a motion where the U.S. attorney says, well, there's this opinion and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, there's that opinion. And he was, this attorney was very closely quoting the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals because they were in it. And this justice that we were, the U.S. District Court justice we were in, he was hoping to get on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to retire, and that's where he wanted to retire from. And they don't know that I know that, or that the student knows that. But what happened was that I wrote that, you know, we helped a student write that, and that the U.S. Attorney General or his attorney's representative, and in this one it says the U.S. Attorney General by and through his attorney, and it lists both their names. I says, it's abominable that the U.S. Attorney General and this attorney, the Deputy Attorney General, would consider coloring outside the lines, and I use that term, and state that an opinion by an individual, regardless of his position, even if it was the Supreme Court of the United States, could possibly modify, enlarge, or reduce the rights established under the Constitution without having a constitutional Congress or any attempt to legislate that into law that they would even imply. Okay, and that one, we're waiting to see how that one responds. That's a very, very recent pleading that technically actually has not been scheduled for a hearing yet. The hearing date for this 22-page motion that I was talking about from the other state is currently for November 5th. But we're going to see if we can have a response into them by next week. But there was we had a student in Nevada that I shouldn't really be using the states and where the students are, but we had a student that on a traffic stop was detained and charged with multiple felony counts. The district attorney went to the state attorney general, who went to the grand jury and got three, not one, not two, but three felony grand jury indictments. And this was for something that was legal in other states, but the moment he crossed the line into that particular state, it was illegal. And there was a bill in the state legislature to make that legal in that particular state. And we wrote a letter that it's abominable that anyone would consider attempting to prosecute something like this that is a crime, a victimless crime, and is legal in all the surrounding states, just made legal in one of them, and that there's currently legislation in this state to make it legal, and then charged with not one, not two, but three felony grand jury indictments embellishing what it was transpired over $40 worth of purchase at a truck stop. And I got a call from a lady. She was just absolutely shocked. She was kind of stammering and stumbling a little bit, and she said, John, we just got a check in the mail. And from the state. I says, what do you mean? She says, it looks like it's the exact amount of the cash bail that I posted for husband. And nobody gives up that much nickels with that many zeros between a whole number at the left of the decimal place and a decimal place like that without a good reason. Well, it turns out, and I says, well, we need to call the the clerk's office in the morning on the case and find out what's happening, et cetera. And she said she called up the clerk's office and wanted to find out what was happening. And the clerk says, I'm sorry, there's no case with that number pending, you know, she says, well, there's supposed to be a hearing a week and a half from, it's supposed to be like 10 or 12 days from now, you know, and she says, ma'am, didn't you get notice? I says, and she said, no. And she recounted what happened with the apparently, and the district attorney made a motion to dismiss. And the district, and I followed up personally. I come to find out that the district attorney personally, face-to-face, went to talk to the attorney general at a subsequent grand jury convening that was to happen to be just a couple days later, bought up this one and indicated that et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all three grand jury indictments were canceled, and they returned the bail before the arraignment date. Now, all of that said, that if we can very, very carefully, judiciously, tactfully, and with consideration and unconditional respect for our fellow person and the deputy attorney generals and the attorneys for the state and the attorney for the U.S. government, if we can show them tactfully how they're wrong without being adversarial dictatorial or confrontive, if we can show them that maybe they're due some of the rights that are being demonstrated here, then maybe we not only win our case, but maybe we win them over, and maybe we tactfully, quietly, without any words actually being said, win the cases of countless many that would have come before them in the future, but are never filed. So, to that end, how we proceed is extremely, extremely important. Your Honor, ma'am, Madam Prosecutor, Mr. Prosecutor, sir, I am not a taxpayer. Please, all those things that are bought up here would apply if the relationship between the government and myself was a taxpayer. But I'm not a taxpayer, and they've usurped it. And until they can prove that I am a taxpayer, then none of those apply. My case is to prove that they must prove that I'm a taxpayer. And then, after they prove that, then all of these particular claims and estoppels and jurisdictional matter that they're claiming and the Anti-Injunction Act and declaratory, all of these then would apply. However, until they can prove that, none of these apply. And if we put it together in such a way that the prosecutor kind of slaps their forehead and says, whoa, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. You know what? That applies to me, you know. And if we make them jealous of the arguments that are there that they want them that apply to them, then maybe we even get their help. And with that, I've just about used up my time, and so we're going to return it back to our moderator, Mr. Edwards or Michael. Mr. Keith, or to Michael. And then When we open it up for Q&A, for any of you who have questions and answers, if you're able to stay with the subject matter topic tonight, that's wonderful. If you're not able to, we will entertain questions on any subject matter topic. And I want to thank you once again for the honor and the privilege of serving beside all of you at Restoring Liberty to America. Back to you, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Just as a heads up, we have St. Nicholas here from Arizona, just to let you know. And, of course, we also have the Roman Emperor here, so we'll go from there.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, one and all, for the honor and the privilege of the pleasance of your presence. I guess we'll open up for questions.
Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see that there is a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side in the center of your monitor. Left-click inside of that. Type away your comment or question. Underneath that silhouette, you'll find a place to put your name and some other requested information. Hit submit, and it will pop up on my end, and I will be delighted to lend my voice to your comment or question. So we're just going to wait for this to populate while I check Freedom's Radio and refresh. No questions yet.
By the way, I have a Florida and a California opposite coast. East Coast and Left Coast, or West Coast, I mean, cases right now that are pending before the IRS or that have already been filed or preparing to be filed, we've had the honor and the privilege of some individuals who have adjudicated cases like this or very almost identical cases for many, many years. One of them decided that he wanted to help us because after 19 years of prosecuting cases, that couple that I told you about, he was so shocked that he approached me quietly and asked me to work with two of his nieces and says, please try to make sure it doesn't end up in my court. But he says, can you help them? Because I can't appear as biased if you help me do this. But he says, and I says, who can't appear as biased? He says, thank you. You know, but quietly, because we've been patient, there's people that are starting to see the validity in some of the arguments. And one of the arguments is that if you can levy a tax on a right so as to take away the right or take away their liberty so they can't exercise the right, then is the right not a right, or is the tax improperly imposed? And when you go back to the Declaration of Independence, which is superior to the Constitution, and the Constitution, like the Ninth Amendment, it's very, very clear that, you know, when you look at the Constitution and you scroll down to the Ninth Amendment there, that it says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall. I am hearing some chat in the background there. Somebody just mute their mic. But it says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Okay? Now, it says others retained by the people. So what it means is that there is something that's superior to that, and that is the Declaration of Independence. And it says, we... in capital letter and W-E on the original script, The E is capitalized. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And Abraham Lincoln, in his 1861 Gettysburg Address, makes it very, very clear in his final statement there that he makes a comment that that this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And in that very, very precious November 19th, 1863 address, that last those last couple lines, he reiterates what was stated in the Declaration of Independence. And when we see the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution, the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Okay, you could almost read that, the enumeration of, in the Constitution of certain rights or responsibilities, you could almost roll right in there, responsibilities, shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. You know, the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness means that it implies you have the right to earn a living to, so that you can buy a home, put clothing on your children, put shoes on your wife's feet, and a ring on her finger, you know, and food on the table. There's a, that makes earning a living a right. That is not a taxable activity. Okay? With that, Michael, were there any questions, any star twos up there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Wow. Just waiting for you to finish what your thought on that matter. St. Nick is here. He's raised his hand. Go ahead, St. Nick.
Hey, can you hear me?
Perfectly clear. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes, and honor and privilege to have you on the call this evening, Nick.
Yeah, I was just calling to check up on my situation and see if you had gotten the email that I forwarded.
We need to follow up on that, and that's going to take a little bit more time than I have on the call. can you, call back in the morning first thing? What time do you get shower, shave, shined, and fed in the morning?
I could use 7 o'clock my time.
Pardon? Say it again.
I could do 7 o'clock my time.
So that would be 8 o'clock my time and 9 o'clock Eastern. I guess, are you currently on Pacific? No, that would be 9 o'clock my time, 10 o'clock Eastern. Is that correct?
Because you're
on Pacific time right now, correct?
It's 7 o'clock my time.
Yeah, it's 7 p.m.
Okay, it's 7 p.m. your time. Then tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. your time, Michael, can we schedule St. Nick in for 7 a.m., 9 mine, 10 yours?
Affirmative. I'll just you initiate the call, St. Nick.
All right. Sounds good.
Yes. Thank you very much. Do you have anything related to the subject matter topic this evening?
Not per se. I really like the direction that things are going with all the IRS stuff. And I guess you'll keep us informed on any updates.
Thank you.
Hey, St. Nick, this is the Roman Emperor. I'm glad that patriots like you and I are pursuing this route. And with the help of Brother John. So it's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Well, thank you. I appreciate those thoughts, and I'll try to work up try to live up to your kind words and accolations there. Thank you.
I just have
by
a
the way,
just one.
By the way, let's you and I, we need to see if we can have a call Thursday. With that Thursday afternoon, I'm gonna say Thursday afternoon because sometimes they keep me a day after the surgery. But Thursday afternoon or Friday morning, because I want to talk to you about I want to get into some meat and potatoes about your case.
Yeah, based on this call, I know where you're going to. I also send you all the other motions that you requested
earlier
today. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate you, brother. You bless my heart.
Thank you.
Okay.
Michael has it. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. You can stay.
Okay. I'll call you Wednesday or Thursday. Thanks.
Let's either Thursday evening or what's your Friday morning looking like?
Yeah, I can call you. This is priority.
Okay, yeah, let's do that because if they keep me historically, if they keep me a second day, it usually takes usually Thursday I get home and the term trash doesn't even begin to apply. Today I had a very minor procedure, and I'm so wore out that I almost couldn't do the call tonight. But I want to thank everybody for your patience and your graciousness, sir. The Father's blessings be upon you and your wife, your life, and your family. You take care and have a good evening.
Thank you.
Okay, Michael, is there anything else there? I know he's checking Freedom's Radio right now. While he's checking that, I'm going to just quick go into one thing. The Ninth Amendment also addresses those amendments that come after it, including the 16th Amendment. People say, well, the 16th Amendment is part of the Constitution. They're right. It is an amendment. And at the same time, we have a disclaimer in the Ninth Amendment that makes it very, very clear that there are enumerations within the Constitution that could be in conflict with existing rights, and therefore the 16th Amendment in itself falls underneath that address, and in certain applications of it, the 16th Amendment into itself is not completely bad and wrong. It's just that laying a tax that is akin to an excise tax, which is illegal, cannot be done under the 16th Amendment. There are some individuals. I had a lawmaker from California. She jumped in my face and she says, "Look, the 16th Amendment says from whatever source derived without apportionment." And she, if looks could kill. She was close enough that I had to wipe a little bit of the moisture that came from her her dissertation off my chin at the time when we were in San Diego, and she was very, very upset. And but let me ask you a question: if a legislator has condoning or trying to promote a tax on income which takes away your right or could potentially take away your right because of the penalties that they impose if you don't pay that income tax, would that constitute a conspiracy to deprive an individual of rights under color of law and under 18 U.S.C. 242? And to that end, the thing that's very, very important is that, not 242, 241, but it says, and I'll read that to you. If two or more persons conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate any person, state, or territory, possession, district, to the free exercise and enjoyment of any right or privilege secured them by the Constitution or laws of the United States, because he is of his having exercised the so same. Now, does that sound like two legislators getting together in a congressional session and saying, hey, let's pass this law, and then they pass the law and individuals lose who exercising the superior right lose their liberty and even are confined to prison or eventually lose their life. Let me ask you all a question. This is for you to ponder on, and this is to close it up. And it says, they shall be fined underneath this title and imprisoned for not more than 10 years or both. And if death results from the acts committed in this violation of this section, or such acts include kidnapping or an attempt to kidnap, aggravated sexual abuse, attempt to commit aggravated sexual abuse, attempt to kill or shut, they shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for a term of years for life or both, or may be sentenced to death. Does anybody know what the statute regarding wrongful arrest is? Is that kidnapping under color of law? Do these
under
legislators? Yes. Could these legislators possibly be charged with a minimum second degree, possibly a first degree felony, removed from office because of their violation of their oath of office? And remember, the Constitution is very, very strict and very, very clear that it makes it and if you go into Article 6 of the Constitution, paragraph 3, it's very, very clear that to this one I'm going to pull it up. I'm going to look it up so I make sure I read it correctly, because a lot of the stuff I just quote off the top of my head. Okay, I've got it here. Article 6 of the Constitution, not Amendment 6 to the Bill of Rights, Article 6, paragraph 3. The senators and representatives before mentioned, the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, that means anybody under Article 1, elected officials, Article 2, the president, or Article 3, judiciary, both of the United States and the several states, shall be bound by an oath or affirmation to support the Constitution, which means that that is a prerequisite for them. Article 6, paragraph 3, is a prerequisite for them being able to exercise the authority, rights, privileges, and amenities of office. So if they violated that, does that mean they can continue to exercise that? Well, John, I haven't been officially charged with that, and I haven't been convicted of that. Hold on. Back there, what was it? That's something about back in the Declaration of Independence, it says, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Did I miss something? Was I not very bright? Back to Abraham Lincoln, November 19th, 1863, when he says this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It's literally, that's his last sentence of that 1863 November 19th address. Okay, the people are the highest form of a government. The right of arrest that's given to a sheriff or law enforcement officials is conveyed to them by the people. The people still have the right of citizen's arrest, and actually that is the highest. You know, and we had I've heard this, stand down, sheriff, the feds trumps the states. And I've had the sheriff, you know, and say, no, I'm sorry. The sheriff is the highest authority here with only one exception. And in one case, I heard click, click. And this, at the time, I was only in my mid-40s, but the 63-year-old gray-haired lady had pulled out a 2-inch Smith & Wesson 38 Special and had put it behind that federal agent's ear and says, I'm sorry, Sonny, but the right of a citizen to make arrest is the highest, and you're under arrest. And it, and the sheriff looking at me, Tommy, looked at me. He was the sheriff at the time of Harris County. You know, he looked at me and he says, you know, and he says, I'm sorry, sir. She's right. I have to defer to her. He says, you, and she, I don't know how she did it, but she released the hammer and then pulled it back again and says, this time, Sonny, my finger is on the trigger and my thumb is holding the hammer back. Don't even move. My hands are a little bit itchy, or they're a little bit, she used the term stitchy. And I don't know why she said stitchy, but they're not, my grip isn't real good. And if I should slip, the hammer automatically comes down. So, can you please place your hands over your head? And the 63-year-old woman just, back then, the sheriff, he deferred to her. And, as I understand it, when it came into, the ninth, here in Houston, she appeared as the arresting entity. And, Diane at first didn't accept it. And the sheriff, Tommy, showed up himself. Oh, it was so great. And he says, I'm sorry. And he recounted all of what I just shared with you, that the people, other people, by the people and for the people, and that she still has even a higher authority of arrest, the citizens, than we do. And Diane was choked up. And back then, Diane was still rather liberal. And after many years on the bench, she waxed conservative and a lot of things, and she eventually retired because, and she came to me and told me, John, you're the first person I'm telling that I'm retiring because too many times you bought those little cards into the court, and I've ruled too many times people could come after me and take away everything I own because I ruled wrong. And she says, I want you to know that I've already overturned two of the seven, my own decisions, and petitioned the governor for a pardon to have five of the last seven that I've ruled on in the last 6 years released from prison. Diane, a sitting state district, criminal district court judge, shared those words with me. So, I was in another courtroom just a couple weeks ago. To date, I don't know how to describe it, but I'll give you a little, moment. We left, when we got done, the judge took off his robe, came back out, and I was talking with both the prosecutors, with the district attorney and the deputy district attorney. Oh, she was a deputy district attorney in training. And he says, I thought I was going to have to declare a mistrial when I came out here after the recess, you know, and we were getting ready for oral arguments, and you guys were all laughing and kibitzing together. The district attorney explained the circumstances, and I explained the circumstances, and he had just ruled in our favor. And he says, you know what? And he says, you notice that I called it a tie because, there were errors on both parts and both things. But he says, I can't believe you guys. He says, but the tie always goes to the citizen. And I didn't jump in his rice bowl about the term citizen there, but he says, I have to tell you, in my 26 years, I've never, ever, ever had a case like this ever before. And he says, You know, I just wish more cases ended like this. And everybody was laughing and just, and if you ever see my son, he was there to appear as a witness in this case. We were shaking hands and high-fiving, and the judge gave me a high elbow. He says, I've got a problem right now. He says, I've got a cough, so I'm not going to shake hands. But the judge gave me a high elbow, and the district attorney gave me a hug. She leaned over, and I was in my wheelchair, and she hugged me, and she patted me on the shoulder and then patted me on the head. But to date, I've had the honor and privilege of not leaving a courtroom in an adversarial manner. If you all can ascribe to those considerations so that you're looking at the opponent there as a co-laborer for liberty, then we'll have started to look at it, maybe for the first time in the correct way. With that, I thank you for the honor and the privilege of serving beside you. Back to you, Michael, and tomorrow night's call. Michael, you there? You should probably get your mute off.
Exactly. Hey, Michael in Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes, Michael.
Yes. I caught most of the conversation, but when you talk about the attorneys or the IRS talking about a person, their definition of a person can only be a corporation or a business. It's not a human being.
Yes. Yes, you are so correct.
And I have several points to make. I may be right or wrong or somewhere in the middle. Who knows? But the other thing is the 1933 bankruptcy ended the government. There, it
yes.
Expired.
Yes, and our last truly validly elected senator left office in 1938.
And the next thing is, in the bankruptcy, the postmaster general's in charge of the bankruptcy, so he runs the whole country.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to most people. There was another thing I wanted to bring out. Now I've got a pain in my – I pulled a muscle in my back, so I'm in some extreme pain. And anyway, I know that you're right in what you say about not being adversarial, because they're indoctrinated. And I had an experience today at a post office. I asked a woman to weigh the letter, and I said, is it a half ounce or less? And she didn't give me a straight answer. It was like, well, it's a little over a half ounce, but what method are you using to weigh it? And I was sending a card off. And so she redid it, and she said, yeah, it's a little over. At first it was, no, it's less than a half ounce. And I said, well, if it's less than a half ounce, I'd like to get a 2-cent stamp and mail it. She said, well, I'll have to put the additional charge on the other end. I said, you can do anything you want, but the postal code says a half ounce or less, it's 2 cents, period. That's the law. She didn't like that at all. And I said, it's just a matter of addressing it the right way, non-domestic. She didn't even know what that was. But that's because she's part of the postal service, not the post office. Those people are almost all gone.
Yeah. So, Michael, you are so correct. You know, one evening, maybe Michael Edwards, we should invite Michael to do a tag team, and we'll just do a postal. Michael seems to have an excellent grip on that, and maybe we'll do a strictly a postal class one evening. How's that sound?
That sounds good. Right now I'm up in Michigan working at the Dow Chemical on a job. It's a retrofit. But anyway, what was I going to say there? I found a new source that I was listening to him. His name is George Gordon out of Idaho. Now, I think he's deceased because this was his first broadcast was years and years ago, but they still carry on with the program. He may still be alive. I don't know, but from what I can calculate, it's like 40 years ago. So, and he was old then. So,
hey, watch what you call old there, youngster.
Well, I just turned 75.
It was murder turn 23. I don't know what I'm going to do when I hit 26.
watch
what you're doing throwing around that O word there, youngster. I know it's only a three-letter word, but, you know, watch yourself.
I'm retired and I can still work, and I'm still healthy enough to work, and my local allows me to work without paying a penalty on my retirement. Yes. But if you're under 70 and a half, you'll pay a 38% penalty for working 15 minutes over 40 hours a month. That's a pretty hefty price.
What's the local number you're with?
433 Iron Workers. Their charter hangs in L.A., but I'm out of the Vegas Hall.
I was
18 years.
I was the 727 out of Southern California. But technically I retired January 17th, 1997. And I may have been retired for a year or two, but actually Michael, I find myself in the ministry and the service of my fellow person in my country since then, you know, and so I don't know if you could say that I've really retired. Oh, boy. And I was forced to retire without a retirement. I may have worked in the black sector for a while for the Defense Department and for quite a few years. And I may not be allowed to collect Social Security or any of those. In fact, I've chosen not to. I've had the choice to collect, and the last time somebody said that my monthly thing would be like $3,408 or something like that is what. But my wife and I, we're going to give to the public trust, not take from it. As long as we can give to the public trust, it's our, if we have the blood. And, you know, like you said, you can still work. And I feel exactly the same way. As long as I have the blood and the strength in me to keep on keeping on, I'm going to keep contributing to the public trust rather than taking from it.
Well, I think I'm in fertile ground up here working with these guys out of Detroit. So I just keep putting a little bit out to them at a time.
There you go.
You can't overwhelm them. That's the one thing, is you overwhelm people and it's like just a wall goes up.
Yeah.
They're so indoctrinated, they just don't know.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. We just had a little power flicker here. we're presently getting the preeminences of this latest piece of meteorological entertainment out there in the Gulf there. Yet she's starting to be a little bit of a party animal, and the building's shaking and rattling and rock and rolling at the moment here.
So, I've been through a few of them, I know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, she isn't supposed to come ashore till the morning, but in the meantime, it's a teeny bit of a breeze out there, and a little bit of precipitation, just a teensy weensy bit. I think the water is actually up to the porch front door right now, so we got a teeny little bit of water.
Wow.
Yep, there you go. Well, Michael, thank you for your input tonight. Is there anything else I can do to be an asset or blessing for you, my honored brother?
No, I'm going to hit, I'm in bed, but I'm going to turn the light out because I have to be up at 4 o'clock. So.
Well,
just painting the ease down.
Sounds good, brother. Okay, well, take care. The Most High King's blessings be upon you. Good evening. Back to you, Michael Edwards.
All right. Thank you so very, very much, everyone, for joining us. I think this has been a most interesting call. I think it's been a great call. And, John, we wish you well. Tomorrow night, join us as we will share again once more. You know, when John told me what the call was about tonight, I was going to do an opening comment, which would last maybe a minute and a half, where I was explaining the term taxpayer being a legal term, and its corresponding counterpart is a non-taxpayer. I was going to share with you that there is the corporation soul, which is recognized by the IRS as a, quote, non-taxpayer, end quote. There is the charitable religious trust, which is acknowledged by the IRS as a, quote, non-taxpayer, end quote. And there's also the American National, which is what John was talking about tonight without mentioning it. That's simply because there is only one class of citizen who is indeed subject to the federal income tax, and that's a federal citizen. And, of course, what we're going to talk about tomorrow night is a limited liability company, which, because of its unique creation, the way it was created, how it was wrought into existence, is also a non-taxpayer. So it would be beneficial to everyone on the call tonight to join us tomorrow night. Same phone number, same PIN, same time, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific. And we'll share more information on that. Brother John, we wish you well tomorrow. I'll be speaking with you at 0900 hours, your time, with St. Nick. And prayerfully, we'll have a little bit of time to do one more call that has come up since we've done this call tonight. So until then, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.